Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Listen for our weekly science report. Then you will hear our American history program, The Making of a Nation. But first, this report.
President Donald Trump traveled to the American state of Wisconsin last week to attend a groundbreaking ceremony for a factory. The factory is being built in an old farming community called Mount Pleasant. The Taiwan-based technology company Foxconn Technology Group will use the plant. Trump joined Foxconn President Terry Gou, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and other officials at the ceremony on Thursday. Many people expressed hope that the $10 billion project will help the state's economy. Trump described the company's plans for a high-tech center as the eighth wonder of the world. The president's visit came as he criticized Harley-Davidson, one of Wisconsin's leading manufacturers. The company recently said it will move some of its production overseas because of a European Union decision. EU officials announced plans for a 31% tariff on motorcycles made in the United States. The EU said it approved the new tax to answer Trump's decision to place tariffs on foreign-made aluminum and steel. The Harley-Davidson announcement angered the president. Trump expressed his displeasure on the Twitter social messaging service. Harley-Davidson should stay 100% in America with the people that got you your success. I've done so much for you. And then this. Other companies are coming back where they belong. We won't forget. And neither will your customers or your now very happy competitors, Trump wrote. Harley-Davidson had no immediate comment on the president's tweets. Phil Levy says other U.S. companies are likely to follow Harley's lead and move some of their operations overseas. Levy is with the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University in Illinois. We are likely to see more such business moves as the administration expands its protectionist policies, Levy said. He added that Harley-Davidson has little choice but to move with market conditions. In Wisconsin, many people think raising taxes on steel and aluminum imports will hurt the state. One study last week found that more than half of those questioned, 55%, feel this way. Only 29% think the tariffs will help the economy. The Marquette University Law School reported the findings. The state pretty solidly is doubtful about tariffs, said Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School survey. Last July, Trump stood with Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to announce Foxconn's decision to build the huge plant in the state. Ryan is Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. The factory is being built in his home district. The deal included more than $4 billion in tax breaks from state and local governments. Foxconn promised to create more than 13,000 jobs. It said the average worker would earn about $50,000 a year. Governor Walker and other politicians have said they hope Foxconn will create a high-tech center, much like California's Silicon Valley. However, a local newspaper, the Sentinel Journal, recently reported that Foxconn has changed its plans for the factory. It said the company had promised a Gen 10.5 factory, a term for a factory that creates large television screens from large pieces of glass. Instead, the company admitted it is building a Gen 6 factory, a much smaller and less costly plant that uses smaller pieces of glass. Foxconn said it still plans to build a Gen 10.5 factory in the coming years. Tim Sheehy, president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, continues to support the deal. What Wisconsin can control here is the ability to take a step forward in transforming our economy with an investment in one of the best digital technology players in the world, he said. The deal between Wisconsin and Foxconn involves a lot of money. The company was promised $764 million in local subsidies and a $140 million electric power expansion paid for by power company customers. It was also promised road improvements worth about $100 million and $3 billion in state tax credits. That $3 billion will end up being money paid to Foxconn, since Wisconsin requires no taxes on manufacturing profits. State taxpayers could be paying about 13% of the cost of the factory project and 17% of the wages for Foxconn's Wisconsin employees through 2032. The job subsidy amount is equal to more than $200,000 per job. Trump's support for Foxconn and anger at Harley-Davidson has put Scott Walker in a difficult position. How can the Wisconsin governor continue to work with the motorcycle manufacturer without appearing to contradict the president? Walker, who owns a 2003 Harley-Davidson Road King, released a statement last week. Governor Walker believes there should be no tariffs or trade barriers, as the president stated earlier this month at the G7 summit. It read, I'm Susan Shand.
In early June, people in the area of Salem, the capital city of the American state of Oregon, received a warning on their cell phones. City officials sent a message that read, "Civil emergency. Prepare for action." Within half an hour, the officials sent out a second message. They explained they were not warning of possible violence. The emergency was dangerous bacteria in the city's drinking water. Microscopic plant life called algae had suddenly appeared and spread in the local water supply. These so-called algae blooms poison water. Such events are increasing in lakes across the United States. Researchers say the rise in algae blooms is connected to the planet's rising temperature, or global warming. The researchers say this raises more questions about the effects global warming might have on human health. Wayne Carmichael is an algae expert, formerly with Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. He worked with the World Health Organization to set the first guidelines on safe algae levels for humans.
Carmichael says as bodies of water around the world warm, there are going to be more incidents of sudden algae growth. That's just logical, and it's being borne out, he told the Associated Press. The kind of algae that grow in the sudden, quick way that happened in Salem, Oregon, are technically called cyanobacteria, an ancient group. The bacteria are present in almost all water, but they grow best in warm, still bodies like lakes and ponds. Cyanobacteria have long been connected to animal deaths, but experts only partly understand the poisonous effect they have on humans. High levels can cause liver damage and attack a person's nervous system. In the largest incidents, hundreds have been sickened by the algae in reservoirs and lakes. Officials in some areas now close water bodies used for recreation and post warnings during algae blooms. But less is known about exposure to lower levels of algae, especially over the long term.
Small studies have linked the bacteria to liver cancer, and others have suggested possible links to neurodegenerative diseases. But, Carmichael says, proving those links would require larger studies. Stephen Chapra is an environmental engineering professor at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. He led one of the most complete studies of the relationship between global warming and the growth of algae. Scientists from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency took part. The research was published in 2017. It found that higher summer temperatures and more periods of extreme heat help the growth of algae. Higher numbers of rain shortages lower lake levels in the summer, warming them faster and keeping them warm longer. The scientists also blamed more intense rainstorms brought on by climate change. They said these rains wash nutrients into lakes and reservoirs. Agricultural runoff is especially helpful to algae as farmers use chemicals created to aid plant growth, Chapra says. In 2016, an algae bloom happened in a Utah lake used for recreational activities. The bacteria sickened more than 100 people. Aislinn Tolman Hill is a Utah County Health Department representative. She says when the story received national attention, other states contacted Utah officials about the problem. We started getting calls from other health departments all over the country saying, "Hey, we're dealing with an algae bloom in a lake that has never ever had one before," said Tolman Hill.
Officials only recently started carefully documenting the algae growths. But Ben Holcomb says the growths seem to be becoming more intense. He is a biologist for Utah's environmental agency, and he argues that no state will go unaffected. They're starting earlier They're lasting longer, and their peaks seem to be getting bigger, Holcomb said. It can happen in lakes of any size. In 2014, Lake Erie experienced an algae bloom. The U.S. lake has a surface area of more than 25,500 square kilometers. The bloom forced officials in Toledo, Ohio, to warn people against drinking from the city water supply. The restriction continued for over 2 days and affected more than 400,000 people. Similar incidents have been recorded in recent years in New York, Florida, and California. In Oregon, officials canceled Salem's drinking water warning after several days and then renewed it at a later date. Officials noted that neither state nor federal laws require testing for algae. Researchers say that needs to change. Stephen Chopra of Tufts suggests that all these incidents are the early warning signs of a much bigger problem. It's going to get worse, and it's going to get worse in a big way, he said. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Bob Doty and I discuss American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. Hard economic times and social conflict have always offered a rich source of material for artists and writers. A painter's colors can show the drying of dreams or the flight of the human spirit. A musician can express the tensions and uncertainty of a people in struggle. The pressures of hard times can be the force to lift a writer's imagination to new heights. So it was during the 1930s in the United States. The severe economic crisis, the Great Depression, created an atmosphere for artistic imagination and creative expression. The common feeling of struggle also led millions of Americans to look to films, radio, and other new art forms for relief from their day-to-day cares.
The most popular sound of the 1930s was a new kind of music, swing music. And the king of swing was a clarinet player named Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman and other musicians made swing music extremely popular during the 1930s. Swing music was a new form of jazz. Many of its first players were black musicians in small, unknown groups. It was only when more well-known white musicians started playing swing music in the middle 1930s that the new music became wildly popular.
One reason for the popularity of swing music was the growing power of radio during the 1930s. Radio had already proven in earlier years that it could be an important force in both politics and popular culture. Millions of Americans bought radios during the 1920s. But radio grew up in the 1930s. Producers became more skillful in creating programs. And actors and actresses began to understand the special needs and power of this new electronic art form. Swing music was not the only kind of music that radio helped make popular. The 1930s also saw increasing popularity for traditional classical music by Beethoven, Bach, and other great musicians. In 1930, the Columbia Broadcasting System began a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra on Sunday afternoons. The next year, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, began weekly opera concerts.
In 1937, NBC asked Arturo Toscanini of Italy to lead an orchestra on American radio. Toscanini was the greatest orchestra leader of his day. Millions of Americans listened at Christmas time as Toscanini and the NBC orchestra began playing the first of 10 special radio concerts. It was a great moment for both music and radio. For the first time, millions of average Americans were able to hear classical music by great musicians as it was being played.
Music was an important reason why millions of Americans gathered to listen to the radio during the 1930s. But even more popular were a series of weekly programs with exciting or funny new actors. Families would come home from school or work and laugh at the foolish experiences of such actors as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields. Radio helped people forget the hard conditions of the Great Depression. And it helped to bring Americans together and share experiences.
Swing music, classical music, great comedy programs. The 1930s truly were a golden period for radio and mass communications. But it was also during this period that Hollywood and the American film industry became much more skilled and influential. In previous years, films were silent, but the talkies arrived in the 1930s.
Directors could produce films in which actors could talk. Americans reacted by attending film theaters by the millions. It was a great time for Hollywood. The films had exciting new actors: Spencer Tracy, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, the young Shirley Temple. The most famous film of the period was Gone with the Wind, with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the starring roles of Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often. And by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you're the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
Directors in the 1930s also produced such great films as It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and The Life of Emile Zola.
The success of radio and films, as well as the Depression itself, caused problems for many American newspapers during the 1930s. The trouble was not so much that readers stopped buying newspapers. It was that companies talked about their products through advertisements on radio instead of buying advertising space in newspapers. Nearly half of the nation's independently published newspapers either stopped publishing or joined larger companies during the 1930s. By World War II, only 120 cities had competing newspapers.
Weekly and monthly publications faced the same problem as daily newspapers: increased competition from radio and films. Many magazines failed. The two big successes of the period were Life magazine and the Reader's Digest. Life magazine had stories for everyone about film actors, news events, or just daily life in the home or on the farm. Its photographs were the greatest anywhere. Reader's Digest published shorter forms of stories from other magazines and sources.
Most popular books of the period were like the films coming from Hollywood. Writers cared more about helping people forget their troubles than about facing serious social issues. They made more money that way, too. But a number of writers in the 1930s did produce books that were both profitable and of high quality. One was Sinclair Lewis. His book, It Can't Happen Here, warned of the coming dangers of fascism. John Steinbeck's great book, The Grapes of Wrath, helped millions understand and feel in their hearts the troubles faced by poor farmers. Erskine Caldwell wrote about the cruelty of life among poor people in the southeastern United States, and James T. Farrell about life in Chicago.
The same social concern and desire to present life as it really existed also were clear in the work of many American artists during the 1930s. Thomas Benton painted workers and others with strong, tough bodies. Edward Hopper showed the sad streets of American cities. Reginald Marsh painted picture after picture of poor parts of New York City. The federal government created a program that gave jobs to artists. They painted their pictures on the walls of airports, post offices, and schools. The program brought their ideas and creativity to millions of people. At the same time, photography became more important as cameras improved in quality and became more movable. Some photographers, like Margaret Burke White and Walker Evans, used their cameras to report the hard conditions of the Depression.
All this activity in the arts and popular culture played an important part in the lives of Americans during the 1930s. It not only provided relief from their troubles, but expanded their minds and pushed their imaginations. The tensions and troubles of the Great Depression provided a rich atmosphere for artists and others to produce works that were serious, foolish, or just plain fun. And those works, in turn, helped make life a little better as Americans waited, worked, and hoped for times to improve.
And that is our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world.